And every time they climb up to another higher platform, they would peep out to look at me and look for me from among the sea of parents, and then they would check that I was still paying attention to them. And then after they would locate me, they'd give me a wave and a smile, and then I would return the wave and the smile, and then they'd be ready to tackle the next platform. And as I stood there watching the kids and waiting for Joe to buy a mom or a Billy bookcase or like a Kallax and all that kind of stuff that you get in IKEA, a thought occurred to me. And I think this is a thought that is true whether you are 4 years old or 6 years old or 40 years old or 60 years old. And the thought is, there is nothing like the watchful gaze of a loving father that gives you a sense of safety and security. There's nothing like the look of your father's face upon you that gives you the courage to climb to the next platform. Now, here's the thing about the Christian life. The Christian life is an adventure. And by definition, all adventures come with risk and excitement and danger. It comes with pain and discomfort. But that pain and discomfort serve a bigger purpose. They serve to make you a fuller, more complete person, to help you live life to the full, so to speak. And if that's the case, then the only way that we're going to get through this adventure is if we really grasp and internalize this one very, very important fact, that the Lord blesses you, that the Lord turns his face to you, that his face shines upon you, and he gives you peace in this chaotic adventure of life. Now, let's have a little bit of a background to this passage. So for those of you who are just coming along on this adventure with us, here's what's going on. So as I said, the book of Numbers is about the story of the Israelite people through the wilderness. In fact, the original name for the book of Numbers was actually In the Wilderness. That's what the name of it in Hebrew was. And then some guy came along and changed it to Numbers because there were a lot of numbers in it. I'm not sure if that was a great idea. Now, there is an American Christian author who has a saying that goes, "After a wedding comes a marriage." And I think that's pretty true. Is it true, Toby? Right? After a wedding comes a marriage. What does that mean? Well, the idea is that you've got a wedding. Hooray! Happiest day of your life. Bride and groom. Joy and celebration. Wedding dress. Wedding rings. Feast. The start of a beautiful thing. But after the end of that magical day and you come down from that high, well, the real work begins. The real adventure begins. The relationship begins. And you wake up the next day and you ask yourself the question, am I going to keep my vow today? Are you going to keep your vows to each other? Are you going to stick with each other through thick and thin? Are you going to fix your gaze on each other no matter what life throws at you? Now, you can think of the book of Numbers as metaphorically the start of a marriage between God and his people. Israelites, you've just come down from the mountaintop, the Mount of Sinai. I have taken you out of Egypt, rescued you in dramatic fashion, crossing the Red Sea, 10 plagues, Egyptians drowning in the Red Sea, and now I've made you my people, I've called you my people, you will be my people, and I will be your God. And here the adventure begins. Are you going to stick with God through thick and thin? Israelites, are you going to fix your gaze on him no matter what the wilderness throws at you? So God says, I will be leading you here on this adventure. Now, what's the purpose of this adventure? Well, the end goal of it is that the fulfillment of a promise that God had made, not just to the Israelite people, but way back to their ancestors. God says to them, if you're going to be my people, you're going to need a home. You will not be a people without a place. And so I am leading you to the promised land. Now, on this adventure, there's going to be dangers and challenges and discomforts. But really, honestly, what adventure doesn't have these things? Can you even call it an adventure if you don't have these things? And as you deal with these dangers and challenges and discomforts, will you continue to have faith in me? Will you rely on me? Will you look to me for safety and security? Will you trust that I am leading you even when you feel like you're not in control. So God says, I won't leave you alone and helpless to do that. I will give you my help to remind you of these truths. In fact, the entire book of Numbers is organized around the fact, every aspect of the book of Numbers is organizing Israel's society and the way their camp works to remind them day in and day out that God goes with them. I'll just give you a little taste of some examples here. So first of all, in Numbers, the priestly order is established. So God says to Aaron, who is, by the way, Moses' brother, you are going to be, in a sense, the first priest. And your sons and descendants are going to be the priestly order forever and ever for Israel. And your job is to facilitate all the sacrifices and offerings and the holy temple rituals that mediate God's relationship with his people. Now, speaking of priests, where are they going to do all these offerings and sacrifices and all that? Well, good question. There's the tabernacle. Okay, so the tabernacle, what is a tabernacle? It's essentially a portable temple. It's a travel-sized temple. Okay, so it's a tent. And in Numbers, a lot of time is spent explaining and describing how the tabernacle is in detail. Now, we 21st century readers reading this, it might be kind of weird. What's with all these numbers and details about the tabernacle? The thing we have to understand is all of this is meaningful so that the people would understand that God dwelt in their presence. God said, I'm going to send you on this adventure into the wilderness. Well, I'm going to go with you. God says, you're going to be living in tents. I will live in a tent. Now, possibly the most dramatic example of this is the pillar of cloud and fire. So note it down for you to read later on. Numbers chapter 9. Numbers 9 verses 15 to 23. God issues a dramatic way of letting the people know that wherever they went, God would be leading them. There was it was described as a pillar of cloud, I guess a big vertical shaped cloud, that descended on the tabernacle. And every time the cloud would set out, that would be the Israelites' sign that it was time to move out, break camp, and head out and journey. And every time the cloud would settle, they would settle camp. 2 days, 3 days, sometimes a few months, sometimes a few years even. They didn't move out unless the cloud did. And whenever the cloud moved, they followed. All of this is to say, in big picture and small picture, in macro and in micro, God was leading the Israelites. His presence was with them. Now, all this culminates in the passage that we just read. In Numbers, the first 10 chapters of Numbers is actually, in all the first 10 chapters of Numbers, do you know how far they got? They hadn't even taken one step. All those 10 chapters is actually God preparing his people for this journey. And and that includes the instituting of all the stuff we talked about, the priests and setting up the tabernacle, and even how the Israelites, all their different tribes, are supposed to organize themselves around the tabernacle and all that. But then we get to chapter 6, and God gives the priests, Aaron and his sons, this instruction. He says, you are to use this formula to bless the Israelites. And with this, they will be strengthened, and they will hear this word come from you to know that I will be with them. So it's not that long. Why don't we read it out again? So number 6, starting from verse 23. The Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Now, Israelites, you're going to be heading off into the wilderness. There's going to be dangers and toils and snares, all that kind of thing. And the thing that you need to know is that all along the way, my face smiles upon you. My face shines upon you. I go with you. I will keep you safe. I will delight in you. I will strengthen you with me. And that's the blessing. Now, those of you, if you're not as familiar with like what like the churchy things, there's a thing that we do called a benediction. And traditionally, that's how Christians end their service, like their formal time, with a benediction. A benediction is just a fancy word to mean blessing, a word of blessing. It's essentially a word of assurance, okay? Now, if you look at what this says here, it's very, very similar to a prayer, okay? If I were to use this as a prayer to pray for you and say, "Dear God, please bless these people, please make your face shine upon them," that's what a prayer is. But the reason why this isn't a prayer is because God himself instructs the priests to give this word to his people. So it's actually a little bit more like a promise. It's God promising that this blessing will be true for the Israelites in the desert. So if you look at it, maybe just to give you just to break it down a little bit, it's just three very simple lines. There's a lovely, each line has a lovely bit of paralleling to it. So each line starts with the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord turn his face to you, the Lord make his face shine on you. Now, an interesting thing, and this is something for you to file away whenever you read the Old Testament, if you are reading the New International Version, the NIV, which is the version that we use here at church most of the time, you will notice that the Lord is capitalized, capital L-O-R-N-D. When that happens, it's because there's actually, in Hebrew, there's two names for God that comes up a lot in the Old Testament. The first one is Yahweh, and the other one is Adonai. Now, Adonai is more of a generic term for God, but Yahweh is actually God's personal name. Whenever you see capital L-O-R-D, you are reading Yahweh. You're reading God's personal name. And so here in this benediction, God uses his personal name to say, "I'm going to be the one that goes with you. Make no mistake. It's me, your God, the same God who brought you out of Egypt, the same God who formed his covenant with you in Sinai." Okay? Now, just one more thing to notice about this blessing. Fun fact, there are a lot of blessings in the Bible, especially the Old Testament. And I didn't know this, actually, until I was preparing this sermon. But you'll notice that usually, when you read a blessing, it usually comes with specific content. So when I say, when God blesses you, he blesses you with something. May the Lord bless you with financial prosperity. May the Lord bless you with land. May the Lord bless you with children and offspring. May you have these things. May these things be your blessing. But what do you notice about this blessing here? There's no specific content, is there? In this one here, the object of the blessing is God himself. He doesn't say, "May you have this and this and this. May you have a fancy home and a nice car and lots of kids and all this stuff." He says, "May you have me. May you have my favor. Forget gifts, forget content. Forget material blessing. May you have the source of blessing himself. May you have me." So the whole point of this blessing is to hammer home this one fact, that as you set out on this adventure in the wilderness, no matter what you face, you will have me looking over you. I will be watching you. No matter how high you climb, whatever platform you get up to, no matter how dangerous your situation becomes, I'm present. You've got eyes on you. There's no real danger. I'm just right there. There's no real danger, no matter what you're experiencing. Just safety in my gaze. And so this is how it's supposed to work. Okay, how the blessing is supposed to work in the life of God's people. God's blessing protects God's people from faithlessness. And so let's say along the way, discomfort comes around. Okay, we've got a real example. All right, Numbers chapter 11, just before mission month, I think it was Reverend Ying that preached this chapter. There's no meat in the desert. Okay, we've been walking for a while now, and every single day we've had the same thing to eat: manna for breakfast, manna for lunch, manna for dinner. And I'm getting tired. I'm getting a bit malnourished. I'm a bit anemic. We're crossing the desert, man. I need some protein. I'm like, wasting away. I'm not getting my, you know, 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight I need in order to maintain my muscle mass and all that kind of thing. And so I'm getting a little bit anxious. No worries. Aaron and his sons, the priests, they give this blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you. Lord, Lord, make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Oh, well, okay. What a calming, centering word. What a word of promise. What a word of assurance. And now the people remember that they are safe in God's hands. Look at that. Look, the pillar of cloud. It's been there this whole time. Look, the tabernacle, the center of our camp. All the people camp around the tabernacle. God's been here the whole time. His face has been shining upon us the whole time. The people calm down. They get centered. They find peace. They find rest. They eat a bit of manna. They head out. God's face gives the Israelites security. With security, their fear fades. And as their fear fades, they journey with joy and obedience and worship. And in all this, by the way, God is glorified. In their courageous obedience, God is glorified. So what might it look like for us? Like I said, the Christian life is an adventure, and patterns happen from the Bible, and we experience the same patterns, all right? Let's say you experience a metaphorical wilderness in your Christian life. The cost of discipleship rises. You're experiencing a bit of discomfort. You are sick of eating the metaphorical manna. My faith is costing me opportunities at work. I can't stay late at work because I got to get to growth group and do Bible study. There are important socials and things that happen on a Sunday that I can't attend. My faith is costing me in social capital because I've got obligations that my non-Christian friends and connections don't have. My faith is costing me options in romance, in family. It's creating friction in my relationships. It's making life more difficult. This is hard. The wilderness is hard. It's long, and I'm thirsty, and I'm tired. And then you hear the benediction. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. It's okay. What a recentering, calming word of assurance. If this is true, then I can get through anything. I don't have a worry. I don't have fear. I can continue to obey. I can continue to live by faith. I can continue to journey this adventure with confidence and worship. Now, if that was all it to the story, then I suppose we could finish this sermon here. But unfortunately, this was the formula and how things were supposed to work, but things didn't exactly work out in reality according to the formula. And the formula went a bit wrong for the Israelites. And we've got a bit to learn from their mistakes as well. And so let's look at what happened in reality, okay? A bit of discomfort rolls around. They're sick of eating manna. They want to eat some real meat. What do they say? Look at Numbers 11, verse 4. Numbers 11:4, the rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing. If only we had meat to eat. They start grumbling. They start complaining. They start whinging. Have a look at verse 1. Go a few verses back, the start of the chapter. Numbers 11:1. Now, the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and we heard them. His anger was aroused. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that that complaining and grumbling is a persistent motif throughout this book, page after page of it. In God's faithfulness and provision, the Israelites respond with faithlessness and lack of gratitude. Verse 5, we remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost, and also the cucumbers, melons, and leeks, and onions, and garlic. Now imagine that. Imagine, can you picture how insulting this is? Imagine being so ungrateful for God's rescue that at a little bit of discomfort, they wish that they were back in slavery again. You remember what was happening back then? You were laboring, not to fill your own stomach, but to fill someone else's. You were breaking your back for the glory of the Pharaoh. You were enslaved to the Egyptians. You were enslaved to sin. And at a bit of pain and danger and risk, you look longingly with rose-tinted glasses at the past slavery. And I'm sorry to say, that's what happened. That's what happened to the Israelites. God says, I rescued you out of Egypt. Now I'm leading you to the promised land. And the Israelite says, I haven't had meat in a while. God, you're the worst. God says, even though you walk through the wilderness, I will go with you. Look at my cloud. Look at my tabernacle. The Israelites say, you've led us here to die. We should go back to Egypt. God says, no matter what, I'm watching you. My face shines upon you. I dwell within your presence. And the Israelites say, not good enough. I don't believe you. I don't feel safe. Let me ask you a personal question. In your Christian life, do you feel safe? Or are you frequently anxious? Anxious about the future. Anxious about what hasn't happened yet. Anxious about not being in control. And in that anxiousness, you grasp for control. I've got three kids. In the first story, I was talking about the older two. I've got my youngest daughter, Naomi. She's a bit over one now. She's unlike the other two. She's a little bit of a daredevil. She's the most fearless one of the three, I've noticed. And you can ask Joe, she would agree. One time we were at the jungle gym at the playground near where I used to live. And there's a platform on that playground that kind of, I don't know why they designed it this way, but there's no barrier or fence or anything. It was just a platform about maybe this high, and then there was just a sheer drop. And I decided that day to test her. I just wanted to see what would happen, okay? See how far she'd go. And so she climbs up, she's at the barrier, she comes up and she's at the platform. And I stand very carefully, I calculate about maybe precisely 1.5 meters away, okay? Far enough to signal to her that I wasn't gonna catch her, but close enough so that I could catch her if worse comes to worse, okay? She starts taking a step to the barrier and I go, no, 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 Naomi, don't do it. She looks at me, takes another step. I go, oh, no, 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 be careful. She looks at me again. I look at her. She sees me looking at her, and she goes, and just goes, and she starts. And I dive in to catch her. And I thought, okay, all right, so lesson learned. Okay, that's what she's like. That's her character. And I knew none of the other kids, they would never have done that. Okay, this wasn't like every single kid, all right? But I just thought, why would you do that? Like, and I mean, like, you're not supposed to expect any rationality from kids or anything like that. But she called my bluff. We played chicken and I lost. She won. I blinked. Why did she win? Because she knew. Naomi knew that even though it looked like I was far away, that there was a gap, there was a chasm, it wasn't a real one. It wouldn't impact her safety because she saw that I was still looking at her. It would have been a different story if I was playing on my phone. And I'm going to admit that sometimes that happens, right? But she saw we made eye contact, and that made all the difference. So long as the Father who loves you is looking at you, the distance doesn't matter. The gap doesn't matter. He might seem far away, but he is close enough. Now that's what the Israelites should have realized. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. But they didn't have peace because all they saw was the gap. All they saw was the distance. And they thought it's too far away. And maybe many of us We do the opposite of what my daughter Naomi does. We fear. The gap's not a real gap, but it terrifies us. I don't know if my life will turn out okay. I don't feel secure. I don't feel safe. I want to go back to Egypt. And, you know, this is what idolatry is about. And this is what sin actually looks like. Sin is the offensive belief that God's promise is not good enough. It's the belief that his gaze is not secure enough for me. Now, in the coming weeks, Reverend Winston's going to continue on, like I said, in our journey. We took a step back to the preparation stage, chapters 1 to 10. We're not going to stay here for very much longer because we're going to get going on the journey. And as Winnell preaches, he's going to show us how this faithlessness and disobedience is going to take place in Numbers. It's going to take place in the Israelites. It culminates in this one moment where they get cold feet, they chicken out, where God tells them they should march on ahead and take the promised land, and disaster strikes. But I won't spoil it too much because we're going to be heading there anyway. I just want to say that the most heartbreaking thing that I've seen in my pastoral ministry is people getting scared because of a little bit of danger. I just can't believe that God is enough. I need that job. I need that non-Christian man or woman. I can't bring myself to find my significance and worth in God alone. So I need that prestige, that status, that approval of my peers. And this one hurts. It hits close to home for me. I'm terrified of not being in control of my life. I don't want to live without regrets. I don't want to be on God's journey. I want to be on my own. I don't want God to be in control of my adventure. I want to be in control of my own adventure. And so I can't surrender to God. I need control. And that's tragic. But what do we do? What do we do? Well, here's the good news, and we'll finish with good news. The good news is that even in our faithlessness, God is faithful. And even in our disobedience, God is kind. And even when we don't deserve his favor because we didn't fulfill our end of the covenant, he goes around and he does it for us. He says, I will fulfill your end of the bargain. I will do it all for you. Now, by the way, don't think too harshly of the Israelites. The only reason we're reading about this is because we can relate so much to it, right? And so they didn't have enough. They had the tabernacle, but it wasn't enough. And they still didn't feel that way. What do we have? What do we have to tell us and remind us and give us assurance that God's favor is always on us and that there's no real danger in the adventure that we live in our Christian life? Well, if all of Numbers is telling us about God dwelling with his people, when you look to the New Testament, the pattern gets repeated. God continues to dwell with his New Testament people, but then he does it in a newer, greater, more superior, and powerful way. If you look at John chapter 1, verse 14, in the beginning of this gospel, this is what he says. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. See, in Jesus, God says, if you are fearful because I seem too far away, then I will come to you. I will close the gap, that meter and a half of distance or whatever that's giving you cold feet. I'll close the gap. I will dwell among you. And don't think I just cherry-picked this verse, all right? There's a direct thematic word connection in this verse to what's going on in Numbers. See, what happened is the tabernacle in Hebrew, there's a term, the word for God's glory in his presence is Shekinah. And I want you to hear the consonants, Shekinah, all right? And that for the Israelites symbolized God's presence and his glory. And here in this verse, the gospel writer happened upon one of the most wonderful coincidences in human language, and that is that the Greek word for made his dwelling sounds a lot like that Hebrew word. It's skenao. Here are the consonants. Sk-n-o. And when Jesus came and made his dwelling among us, he is the glory of God. Jesus is the new way that we know that God is with us. So long as we have Jesus, we know that we will always be safe. There's no real danger in the Christian life. There's no real risk in obeying and worshiping God. And there's more to it than that, okay? Because God said, I promise I will be with you, and the Israelites still turned away from him and rejected him. But in the New Testament, what we find is that Jesus then lives a faithful life. He lives in perfect faith and obedience in a way that we never could. And then God turned his face away from him. In just after this, in our response song, we're going to sing these lines. How great the pain of searing loss. The Father turned his face away. Do you know there's nothing more terrible than God turning his face away from you? Even if you think about human relationships and human fathers and human sons, there's nothing more terrible than God, than your father not acknowledging you. Daddy, daddy, look at me. Here I am up on this platform. But I'm not looking at them. I'm playing with my phone, right? And you know, every playground now, there's always a warning that says, parents, don't, you know, be on your phone, be attentive, be mindful, because that's just how life is these days, right? Daddy, daddy, look at me. No. Daddy, daddy, acknowledge me. No. Daddy, daddy, delight in me. No. That is the worst curse. That is the curse that Jesus endured for us on the cross so that we would not have to experience that. And so here is the heart of our faith in a nutshell. The gospel truth is that Jesus did that for you. So that when you look to Jesus, you know that God will never turn his face away. That these words of blessing that God had initially given to his Israelite people are for you. They are fulfilled in Jesus in a greater way than we could possibly imagine. God delights in you. When you think you don't matter, when you think no one's looking and no one cares, the God of the universe cares. He gives you this promise. He's looking at you. Everything you do matters. So it's okay. Climb the next platform. Get up higher and higher. Look at how dizzying the height is, how far away the ground is. There's no fear. There's no danger. There's no real risk. Because God has always, ever been with you. That is the promise that comes here originally for the Israelites and now for us in Jesus. So let me finish up here. In just a moment, I'm going to give you guys a minute or so maybe to reflect and to let these words sink in, maybe even to say to pray and speak privately to God. What does it mean for you to have this assurance? What would it look like for your life to have this assurance, to know that there's no real risk? Could you then enjoy the more fun parts of the adventure you're living? See, I don't like adventure. I don't like uncertainty. I like being in control. I like knowing what's going to happen next. You know, I like, well, this isn't true, but it's kind of like if you're about to watch a movie, you know, you go on Wikipedia and you check the plot, so you know what's coming before you watch the movie. That's kind of how I approach life. But that's not how life works. That's not how the Christian life works. You don't know what's going to happen to you tomorrow. You don't know what danger you're going to face. You don't know what grief or loss you're going to have to endure. But whatever you endure, can you face it if you know that the Lord will bless you and keep you? That the Lord's face is turned to you. That his face shines upon you. That he's gracious to you and gives you peace. Let's take a moment then to reflect and pray and maybe give thanks. Father God, you have called us on a spiritual journey. We are heading towards the promised land. But here we are in this life, in the overlap of the ages, where you reign, but your kingdom has not yet been consummated. And there's risk and danger and pain and toil and suffering. Help us to face those things with confidence and joy. Help us to have great faith. Help us to live with faith and obedience. Not because we have a tent in the midst of us, but because we have Jesus, the Son of God. In him is your glory. And we have seen it. We have seen your glory. Let that give us confidence to live for you and worship. In your Son's name we pray. Amen.